From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Democrats on Beacon Hill and Capitol Hill lay out their agendas for the year ahead with the GOP.
What I'm looking for is good policy to help America move forward. And if they can do that, well, then I can compromise. If they can't do that or won't do that, well, then I'll do my best to block that agenda.
We'll dig into that and other stories in our Week in Review. Also today, we talk with the new dean of Harvard Medical School, and we take a look at the spring real estate market in Greater Boston, plus three recent movies taking place in Massachusetts, all with different takes on loss and grief.
What's in Boston? You're a janitor.
So what?
You could do that anywhere. There's plenty of toilets and clogged up drains all over town.
I don't want to
All my friends are here.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. At the end of this first week of the new year, we're going to take a look at the issues making headlines these past few days in our Week in Review. We've got Senator Elizabeth Warren confirming her re-election bid today and some of the battles shaping up on Capitol Hill.
The first order of business is to repeal and replace Obamacare.
That's Vice President-elect Mike Pence speaking Wednesday after meeting with some congressional Republicans. Also this week, President Obama met with congressional Democrats, including Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark. She announced that she's sitting out the presidential inauguration later this month.
We have a situation here where the Republicans are willing to push the American people out of the airplane with no parachute.
And state lawmakers laid out their agendas when they were sworn in this week. Joining us to talk about all of this and more are our panelists, Renee Loth. She's editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is a new voice, D.R. Tucker, political contributor to Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. So before we get to Capitol Hill and Senator Warren's announcement today about her reelection bid, let's start on Beacon Hill. State Senate President Stan Rosenberg was reelected to lead the Senate this week. And shortly after that, he came on our show to tell us about some of his priorities. Let's listen.
We have a responsibility to look to the future and make sure that we're addressing two of the fundamental pillars of our economy, which is an educated workforce and a transportation system that supports getting goods and people to where they need to be as efficiently as possible, and preferably in a way that reduces our carbon footprint and our impact on climate change.
And on the House side, Speaker Robert DeLeo said this.
One of our first order priorities is going to have to be addressing the marijuana issue.
Governor Baker also said the issue of recreational marijuana legislation is front and center this session. Is this the main issue facing lawmakers right now, Renee?
Well, you know, the people always complain about how the there's one party rule in on the Beacon Hill. You know, that the legislature at least is controlled overwhelmingly by Democrats. But Stanley Rosenberg and Bobby DeLeo might as well be from two different parties. I mean, they really don't agree on many things. They represent opposite wings, really, of the Democratic Party. Here's DeLeo. He's much more conservative. He wants to hold the line on taxes. He's very concerned about the marijuana legislation. And then here's Rosenberg on the other side, who is, you know, in his opening address, talked about income inequality and supports the millionaire's tax that's likely to be on the ballot next year. So I see these two leaders of the two branches of the, you know, the legislature as being, not in lockstep and in many ways opposed to each other.
How do you think that'll play out? Do you think we'll see a lot of battles?
Well, I mean, I think we did in last year actually see sometimes some rather personal battles between Rosenberg and DeLeo, with Charlie Baker kind of as the peacekeeper between the two. So I think we may see more of that. To the extent they can focus on policy, I think that would be better for everybody.
You know, the governor told reporters this week that he plans on pushing an economic growth agenda and continuing to fight the opioid crisis. This is what the governor said.
We're going to continue to work on the addiction issues, which have been a major opportunity for us to work with our colleagues and with others here in the Commonwealth. I still talk to too many people who feel that people who are dealing with addiction are uncomfortable speaking about it because there's a certain stigma associated with it. I think we need to continue to make progress on that.
Now, there has been a lot of talk about the governor's budget cuts, especially cuts that affect addiction treatment services. And some accuse the governor of saying that he's committed to the opioid epidemic and reducing stigma, but his actions not necessarily supporting that. DR, what's your take?
He's committed to taking action in theory. It's hard to sort of lead on this sort of issue if you're not willing to invest in taking action on this issue. And this goes back to the whole sort of ideological thing of believing that, you know, you don't need new revenue in order to address problems. And somewhere along the line, you do get the sense that at some point there has to be a serious conversation about the need for more revenue to address problems like opioid addiction.
Right.
It's not going to solve itself, basically.
Right. Baker's still wildly popular, though. He's very, very popular governor. Do you see that changing at all?
Well, when people always ask me about Baker's popularity, I always say that, you know, there was a time when George W. Bush was very, very popular, and look what happened. So popularity is one of those things where it may appear to last, and then it just takes one issue, one controversy, and all of a sudden things start turning around, and they could turn around, especially on this issue. When you look at so many people in this state suffering from the consequences of the opioid crisis, and when you realize that the money is not there because of the whole mentality of we can't raise 1 cent in revenue, well, at some point that popularity might begin to take a dip.
Right. Go ahead.
I think that's very well put. You know, I think that this is a problem for Baker on a number of fronts. You know, his, you know, sort of lockstep opposition to any kind of increase in taxes, which, of course, does contribute to his popularity with the voters. And how does that reconcile with his, I think, sincere commitment to trying to do something about the opioid crisis? But, you know, without being able to get any money behind it, you know, talking about stigma, that doesn't cost anything. You know, trying to change people's attitudes, that's very nice. But ultimately, people need treatment, and they need treatment when they want it. You know, in the moment, when they decide they're ready to get treatment, there has to be a bed available for them right then. And that's always been our problem in the state, and it's still a problem.
Also, speaking of Governor Baker, he did announce that he will be attending President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration later this month. The Clintons are going, former President George W. Bush going. But yesterday, Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark said she's going to skip it in protest. And this comes a day after she told us on Radio Boston that she would be willing to work with the administration on issues where there is common ground. In skipping the inauguration, what do you think? Is this something that is a big statement on her part and perhaps a dangerous one? DR.
I don't think it's a dangerous statement at all. She has the right to decline attendance, and others have a right to attend if they so choose. Catherine Clark has basically made it quite clear that, you know, when she looks at the agenda that President-elect Trump is trying to implement, that's not something that one necessarily, in her opinion, wants to endorse with her physical appearance. And that's totally fine. Just as, you know, I note that there's some controversy about Hillary Clinton wanting to attend, and she has a right to attend as well. It's an individual choice, basically.
Well, we did get a statement from the Mass GOP. It said this narrow-minded partisan stunt on the part of Congresswoman Clark shows that she cares more about scoring political points than respecting democracy. It says, quote, her boycott of the inaugural is such an extreme rejection of bipartisan tradition that even her Democratic colleagues won't join her. Renee, what do you say to that?
Well, that's sort of the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it? I mean, you know, the Democrats certainly don't need to take lessons about, you know, partisan gridlock and obstruction from the Republican Party or the other way around. I don't think it's going to hurt Kit Clark. She's a rising star in the Democratic Party in the sort of Elizabeth Warren wing, although Elizabeth Warren is attending the inauguration as DR says, it's a personal choice. I do think that the Democrats need to really take seriously their watchdog role in this next 4 years. I mean, the Trump administration and his supporters, and you know, he's not even sworn in yet, are very good at distracting the American people from you know, their quiet dismantling of democracy, which I see you know, as a real serious possibility. You know, the for example, the hearings on the cabinet appointees. The Trump administration has scheduled something like six of them on the same day, at the same time that Donald Trump is going to have his first much delayed press conference. So, you know, there's going to be tons of distractions. It's going to be very difficult for the press and for other watchdog organizations to really give the scrutiny that those cabinet appointees deserve. And that's the role of the Democratic Party, I think. You know, going to the inauguration or not is really just symbolic.
Mm. You know, speaking of which, we heard from Seth Moulton, who spoke with us earlier this week as well about the incoming administration. And this is what he said about Democrats and Trump's policies. Let's listen.
So much of what Donald Trump said during the campaign and has said since the campaign is dangerous for working families. His economic plans are disastrous, dangerous for our troops. He has no clue about foreign policy, and he's going to put young lives at risk.
And D.R., I wonder what your take is on the members of the Massachusetts all-Democratic delegation pretty much operating in the Trump era.
Mm. Well, there is something to be said for embracing the ethos that turnabout is fair play. If members of the delegation believe that Trump's agenda is injurious to democracy, injurious to the public, they are well within their rights to basically do whatever it takes to say no to that agenda. Just as when Republicans believed that President Obama's agenda was injurious to democracy, they were obviously politically well within their rights to do the same. I mean, there is something to be said for believing that sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, and that, you know, that Democrats should do unto Republicans what Republicans have done unto them.
But do you think, how do you think this will affect us here in Massachusetts? Any predictions from either of you?
Well, there obviously could be some degree of backlash. I mean, we recall when President Nixon, I believe after he was reelected in 1972, he vetoed, I believe, I think it was the Charleston Navy Yard, or there was some specific project that he vetoed out of revenge for the fact that the state went for George McGovern. And we could see that sort of vindictiveness from the president-elect. But if that does indeed happen, I'm sure that the congressional delegation will be quite vocal about the nature of what he's doing.
You know, earlier we mentioned Senator Warren, who did announce today that she is, in fact, running for reelection. No big surprise there. But what do you think her role is going to be like, especially after Inauguration Day? I mean, she's already considered sort of the voice against the president-elect. Is that going to strengthen, do you think, Renee?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I just said, it's important to really take seriously this watchdog role that the opposition party or the minority party, you know, traditionally has. And she's very good at this. She also, you know, she's not shy about calling out what she sees to be serious attacks on our democratic system, small d. But I also think that she, you know, is a lawyer, and she understands some of the legal, sort of the murky legal areas that the Trump administration has, or that Donald Trump, president-elect, has said that he's wading into. So I think she'll be able to call those out with some authority.
I want to talk about some other news this week that's got national political ramifications. Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson offering president-elect Trump his inmates to help build the wall on the Mexican border. Now, we should say the president-elect has not responded to this proposal, but here's Hodgson explaining it Wednesday.
I'd like to see us do this. I think it's really worthwhile. You know, these are people that have low self-esteem, don't think that they really can accomplish something, who would be involved in a national initiative that they can come back and say, hey, listen, I made a difference. We've seen it in our own county.
I wonder, DR, your reactions to this proposal from Sheriff Hodgson.
I think this is a proposal that's going to go nowhere by virtue of the fact that I don't believe that this effort to sort of build a wall is going to go anywhere. The only wall we're going to see is on an old Pink Floyd album, basically. the whole initiative to try to build a wall, and I know that the Congress is trying to come up with some sort of funding for it. I guess the proposal of having Mexico pay for it has now been tabled. It's going to be, I predict it's going to play out similar to George W. Bush trying to reform as he viewed it Social Security and how that went nowhere. And I think Sheriff Hodgson is simply sort of engaging in a fair bit of a self-promotion. But this whole proposal to sort of, you know, get inmates to build a wall is just all theory and all fiction and no fact, basically.
We did speak with Vincent Schiraldi about this. He's a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Program in Criminal Justice, and he was was head of juvenile corrections for Washington, D.C., and this is what he said about Sheriff Hodgson's plan.
A lot of good could come from having people who have run afoul of the law repay their debt to society by doing works in the community. And it's a real shame to start that with probably the most divisive public works project perhaps in the history of America.
So, Renee, I'm wondering, is there, a public benefit to having inmates help in big public work projects like this? And then, of course, what are some of the pitfalls that maybe aren't so obvious even?
Yeah, Charlie Baker, when was sort of cornered by this or surprised by this proposal of the sheriff's, was asked about it. He said he'd rather see the inmates working on projects closer to home. That was how he managed to get out of that quandary. This is totally in keeping with Sheriff Hodgson's, M.O. He is has a reputation as a tough guy, shoots from the hip. I think he sees this Donald Trump's election as his moment. It's tempting to dismiss this as kind of, amusing or, impossible. But, of course, a lot of people dismissed Donald Trump and some of his wackier ideas initially, too. So I would say, though, that, almost half of the inmates in the Bristol County, Corrections Department are pre-trial detainees awaiting trial. They have not yet been convicted of anything either, right? So the idea of rounding them up into some sort of indentured servitude and sending them down to Mexico or Texas to build a wall, it doesn't pass the constitutional smell test, or even maybe the laugh test. So I think this project's going nowhere.
But I wonder, it raises questions, doesn't it? You mentioned, Sheriff Hodgson's past and other controversial moves that he's made. He's charged inmates for being incarcerated, and he's sort of done these things unilaterally. It raises the question of, can a sheriff just do this, and groups would need to sue to make a sheriff stop? I mean, what do we know about that?
Sheriffs really do run their own fiefdoms. I mean, he's an elected, public official. He's been reelected twice, I think, his third term, I believe. And so, the people of Bristol County seem to not be too upset with some of his more, controversial statements. So I think within his own department, he stopped serving orange juice to the inmates. He got rid of TV and smoking and, put together these chain gangs, right? You may recall, shackled those workers who were out on the highways, cleaning them up and so on. So within his own department, I think he's able to do quite a lot. But when he steps into, other jurisdictions, I think it's a lot murkier.
Let's talk about a study that came out this week, because there were some dramatic numbers in that study. It was a study done by the Boston Women's Workforce Council in City Hall, and it found that working women in Boston, on average, make 23% less than men, 77 cents on the dollar, and that there's a gender wage gap, a significant one. And this is the first time that researchers have used data collected directly from employers to prove that there is a gender wage gap. Here's Mayor Marty Walsh.
This is a groundbreaking moment in tackling the gender gap. And this isn't about us talking about filing legislation and passing legislation and kind of waiting to see what happens with that legislation. This is Boston and the council taking action on how do we actually deal with and work on the wage gap.
D.R. Tucker, I wonder, what's your reaction to this? Do you think we'll see some changes because of this report?
I definitely hope so. Equality is always better, I say. And I couldn't help noting, reading the story in the Boston Globe, when you go to the comment sections of the story, you have all these people denying that it's real, denying that the wage gap is real. Sort of like when they do the climate change stories and people deny that climate change is real. I mean, they're not making this up. This is a chronic problem. It needs to be remedied. My line is that a woman should make a dollar for every dollar a man earns. Mm. And it's good to see that Mayor Walsh, and it's good to see the business leaders in Greater Boston taking this seriously and trying to lead on this, because, again, it just makes not just moral sense, it makes economic sense to reduce the wage gap to nothing, to where, you have equal pay, truly equal pay for equal work. There was a law that was passed last year basically saying that, employers can no longer question women about how much they earned previously by virtue, because, doing that essentially traps women in lesser wage jobs for their entire careers, and it's a good thing that the legislature passed that, but so much more needs to be done, and I believe will be done by Mayor Walsh and by the business leaders in Boston.
Now, many folks have said that these numbers are skewed to a certain degree. They're not completely accurate. That's why they say it's not real, right? Because they say, well, women take time off, they raise children, they tend to be the homemakers more, they want a flexible schedule. So when you compare the salaries, it's like comparing apples and oranges and not apples to apples. Do you think, Renee, that this report gets rid of that argument?
No, I think there's some truth to that, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't intend to blame the victim at all in this, what I'm about to say. But, you know, our society continues to be set up in such a way that women do take more time off for child caring or parent, you know, the care of their elderly parents and so on. And that does affect their wages overall. You know, if you look at week to week, it's a little bit more of an apples and apples situation. There are ways to try to adjust for those realities. I think until we start to value the work that women do inside the home, outside the home, and also the types of career choices that women make equally to men, that's what we need to be doing. I mean, there have been studies out of universities that show that the most lucrative college majors, you know, engineering and math and pharmaceuticals, tend to be dominated by men. That's not because they require smarter people or that they're more important to our society or anything. It just means that that the society is set up in such a way that it compensates men more than women for, I would say, comparable but perhaps different work.
Okay, I want to end our conversation with hubbubs. Those are the brief stories or events that maybe didn't make it above the fold this week but caught our attention. DR, what's your hubbub for the week?
My hubbub is the closing of the Phillips Old Colony House and the Freeport Tavern in Dorchester. As someone who was born and raised in Dorchester, it's a really sad story. This restaurant has been sort of an iconic presence in the neighborhood for decades. I have a lot of friends who had a lot of, you know, events that have taken place at that restaurant, a lot of life events, and it's a really, really sad. But it's sort of the trend of, you know, old restaurants closing and new restaurants coming up. So,
and that's why it's closing? Because somebody new's coming in? Or what?
Apparently the owners are considering basically using it for using the land for different reasons, but still, you know, so many memories to go as a result of that.
All right. Well, bye-bye, Phillips Old Colony House in Dorchester. Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
My hubbub has to do with the continuing saga of the legalized marijuana initiative. The advocates for the ballot measure, who are still reeling from the legislature's sneaky and possibly somewhat secret vote to delay the measure by 6 months, are now facing the likelihood that the senator who authored that delay, Senator Jason Lewis of Winchester, a Democrat, may be appointed to head a new committee to address aspects of the law. In other words, the legislature is setting up a new committee to look at the marijuana law, and that the senator who is an opponent of the original ballot measure may be appointed to lead that. So the advocates are all up in arms about this. I personally was actually not in favor of the initiative. I thought it was there were going to be a lot of problems, which we're starting to see now in rolling it out. But I do think it underscores how important it is that the legislature needs to move quickly to appoint the 3-member cannabis control commission that the legislation calls for, and just get this, you know, appoint neutral and respected members of that commission and just get this out of politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't have the same issues we had with medical marijuana.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my editorial.
Okay. Well, mine is completely silly. Can I say a little cheeky? This Sunday, the Boston Society of Shenanigans will be holding its annual No Pants subway ride on the MBTA. More than 100 people are expected to board the T and drop their pants unexpectedly, wearing their underwear. This is the 9th annual No Pants subway ride. And so when the MBTA was contacted about this, a spokesman said the T has no position on this event. So I think that's my hubbub for the week, and I'm sticking with it. And pants are staying on. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you.
Thank you.
D.R. Tucker, it's great to hear you, political contributor to Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Stay with us. Coming up, a preview of the spring real estate market in Greater Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Rental prices in Greater Boston seem to be slowing down. New data this week from the rental tracking firm Reis show that rent prices dropped by just under 2%. That's $36 a month on an average lease. To talk about why rents might be going down and what it might mean for the housing market overall, we're joined in studio by Greg Vassell. He's CEO of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
So why are rents going down, even if it is really a little bit?
What we're seeing is the production that we have been able to achieve in the last couple of years has really forced the old classic economic supply and demand. We're seeing rents fall because we have more units on the market than we have had in the past.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these units, I'm told, are luxury apartment units. Isn't that right? I mean, we've been reading a lot about these very, very high-end apartments in Boston in particular.
Yes, and the reason for that is because economically they are the easiest to produce in this marketplace with the cost of land, the cost of labor, and the cost of materials.
So if we have a greater supply of luxury units, does that mean that there's a bubble about to burst there somewhere and that prices will be going down for some of those luxury units?
Yes, and we're seeing that some of those luxury units already are falling. We've seen a number of tenants actually jumping from new building to new building, chasing the amenities and the incentives that are offered by landlords that have built them over the last couple of years, which also results in some lower prices for the buildings that they leave, some of the older buildings.
Give me an example of some of the amenities and incentives that are being offered to try to lure people into renting in some of these luxury places.
Health club access within the building, parking, free month rent, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. But still, what are we talking about in terms of an average rent? It's over $2,000 a month.
They're high, yes. We are still working diligently as an industry and with the help of Mayor Walsh and his administration on meeting the needs of those people that fall in the middle. That four-person family, two-income family that makes just under $100,000, that's going to be the real focus. We're seeing a few of those projects coming along now, and they're not going to all rush in like the luxury units did. We're going to have to take them one step at a time because they're very complicated economically, and we have to make sure the numbers work so that they can be produced.
Mm. How do you think this might affect the spring housing market? Typically, the busiest time for the housing market is the spring, or traditionally it has been. Do you think that this oversupply, particularly of apartments in Greater Boston, will affect the housing market overall?
The problem we have on the for sale side of the market is that we don't have enough inventory. So we're always inventory strapped. And one of the reasons why is we have many elderly that don't have a clear place to go to leave their house. So that's one of our issues. So on the for sale side, I don't think there's going to be a lot of impact by this on the marketplace. On the rental side, I think the real impact may come in September when it seems like all of Boston's leases turn over, the students come in. I think we'll really see more in September of 2017 than we will in the spring of this year.
What about the Federal Reserve's decision to raise interest rates? How's that going to affect the market? Will we see any effects from that?
I think that it's been long anticipated, and I think it certainly affects affordability on the for sale side of the equation. It'll make it a little more difficult for those folks that are stretching to get into that first house, yes.
I wonder, we still hear, at least anecdotally, about bidding wars and properties really being difficult. What is this lack of demand going to continue to do to prices, do you think, as we go into the spring market? Is it different when we're talking about maybe luxury condo rental prices are going down, but our average single-family home price is going up because of this lack of inventory? What's happening there?
I think what you're seeing is, as the prices in Boston have escalated over the last several years, you've seen an increase in prices also in the surrounding communities because there were communities that weren't as desirable as they once were, but suddenly are now more affordable. So people tend to go in that direction because they can only purchase what they can afford.
Are we at all near where we were, say, 2006? 2006, 2007, before the bubble? Or would you compare it to that or no?
I don't think so. I think we're in a different place because we've seen the growth of Boston economically with job creation. I think if you look 10 years ago, I think our city was a little bit of a different place than it is today. And I sort of think we're on the cusp. But what we really need to do is we need to be able to create housing for those workers that are going to be working in these, you know, entry-level and mid-level jobs at these companies. Because the worst thing we could do is export all the wonderful students that come out of our system that these companies look to grow on and have join their workforce because they can't afford to live here.
And so how do we do that? How do we create housing for entry-level workers then? I mean, is it what you're talking about, like initiatives with the mayor and things like that?
Yes.
But those are time-consuming.
They're very time-consuming and they're very hard. But if we're serious about trying to come up with a way to keep our economy healthy, we need to do that. We also have to make sure that we don't overburden our system with a lot of regulations and new laws that can affect the ability and the desire of developers to come here. The whole just cause eviction phenomenon is one of those.
Okay, Greg Vassell, CEO of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We want to turn now from real estate to movies. You may be looking to escape this weekend's snow by heading to the theater, and if you don't want to escape too far, a few movies on the big screen right now feature Massachusetts. Joining us to talk about this is Tom Meek, film critic and contributor to WBUR's The Artery. Welcome.
Thank you.
So there are three big movies, at least that we could think of right now, out that feature Massachusetts: Manchester by the Sea, Patriots Day, and Jackie. What do you think ties these three films together?
Well, I think they're all about struggle. Two are about internal struggles, and the third is about a struggle for victims to right the wrong that's gone on. Patriots Day, Manchester by the Sea is a very internalized film, mm-hmm. and Jackie's also internalized film that deals with a widow's grief and trying to preserve her husband's legacy. And she has to struggle against the people that are taking over the White House who don't really sort of aren't on the same game plan with her about how she wants to bury him.
Right, right. And grief was just such a big message in all of these, as you mentioned. You know, grief and Patriots Day, which was about the Boston Marathon bombings, and Jackie and Manchester by the Sea. And we have a clip here from the movie Manchester by the Sea. It's from the trailer, and this is the scene where Casey Affleck's character Lee runs into his ex-wife, who's played by Michelle Williams. And there's a lot unsaid here, but let's listen to this brief clip.
I said a lot of terrible things to you. My heart was broken, and I know yours is broken, too.
No, you don't understand. There's nothing
there.
That's
not true.
That's from Manchester by the Sea. Really powerful scene there.
Very powerful. The film's most powerful scene, and it's, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but they're a married or formerly married couple, and the reason they're not together is because they've had a loss, and he's inadvertently responsible for it. And through most of the film, he's going through internal struggle and trying to deal with redemption and atonement for what happened in the past. It's a very, very gritty and heart-feeling film.
Right. And no sort of Hollywood happy ending there. What do you think that suggests? It's very real. It is very gritty, very real. That's how I've heard people describe it.
Well, the film was done by Kenneth Longerman, and this is his third film. He's the screenplay writer who did analyze that and analyze this film's. And he's worked with Matt Damon before. And Matt Damon and him had conceived of this film, and Damon couldn't take on the role that Casey Affleck had done. So, and I think when they started talking about it, they were thinking about the Massachusetts setting at the time, because obviously Matt Damon has ties here. And Longerman was, and I did speak with Kenneth Longerman briefly before the premiere of the film here, and he was really blown away by the town and had a great time digging into the rich history that was around here and the fishermen and the class struggle that's up there. I mean, we're just talking about rents and prices. I mean, Boston has been a changing place for a period of time.
Right. You mentioned the movie Jackie as well. That movie, Natalie Portman plays Jackie Kennedy, and we have a clip from that movie as well. Here she is asking Jack Valenti to pass along a message to funeral invitees about the procession for JFK's funeral, but it's kind of a threat, really, to those who might be too afraid to walk alongside her husband's casket. Let's listen.
Inform them that I will walk with Jack tomorrow, alone if necessary, and tell General de Gaulle that if he wishes to ride in an armored car or in a tank, for that matter, I won't blame him. And I'm sure the tens of millions of people watching won't either.
Why are you doing this, Mrs. Kennedy?
Oh, I'm just doing my job.
What do you think is the main theme here? Is it that she was always trying to do right by her husband, that Jackie Kennedy was always trying to do right by her husband?
Well, she's trying to do right by the legacy of him and Kamala. And she wants to follow the blueprint of Lincoln's burial with the big procession. She finds it in the books, and this is what she wants to do for him. And the government is afraid of terrorism and the exposure that's involved with it. And that's why de Gaulle wants to ride in the steel car, because he's afraid that Oswald has affiliates out there. Right. So they're paranoid. They don't know yet.
Right. So as you mentioned, there was a very internal struggle going on in Manchester by the Sea. And while there was a lot of internal grief here in Jackie, it was obviously about a big national event. And then we've got Patriots Day, which was, again, about another grief around another event and grief by a group of people. And here's a clip from that movie as well, where Mark Wahlberg's officer in this movie, Tommy Saunders, is trying to convince the FBI to release photos of the suspected marathon bombers.
Right now, Boston's working against us. Yeah, that's normal. You got a murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. Look, you got a lot of people talking, but they're talking about the wrong people. You release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen, trust me. You got to start letting Boston work for us, I'm telling you.
So what do you think? I mean, what do you think of Boston or even Massachusetts almost being like characters in these films? We've seen this before.
Well, I mean, if you listened in the Manchester by the Sea film, Michelle Williams, and she does a very good job of doing that sort of tough, towny talk. Mm. Casey Affleck, I think, according to Longerman, decided to go with his natural accent. But in Patriots Day, I think Wahlberg's trying to pull all that together. His character's fictional, and I think it becomes a bit of an Achilles heel with the film in the fact that he's an amalgam of police officers, and he happens to be at every major event at the forefront of it. So it almost becomes a little bit hyperbolic. But overall, the film does try to tip its hat to the victims, but it becomes more about Wahlberg's character and less about the victims. And I think that sort of it may have been too soon. Mm.
And so I understand that you rated what you thought were the best Boston movies, and leaving off the one that's very well known, The Departed, right?
Well, so I did an article for The Artery a while back, and the best film is The Friends of Eddie Coyle that I think really gets Boston the best. But yes, I did leave off The Departed because most of it takes place down by Government Center in an old psychiatric care home. That's where the FBI station is. And then all the bars that they do that are sort of where the Whitey Bulger character are sort of these very dolled up yuppie bars that are made dirty to look legitimate. Ben Affleck's film, The Town, and Gone Baby Gone, I think, got those angles of the films a little bit more. But you really can't beat, as far as Boston goes, the original Thomas Crown Affair and The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is probably the greatest Boston film, or the greatest film shot in Boston that gets Boston right.
All right. Tom Meek, film critic and contributor to WBUR's The Artery. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk to the new dean of Harvard Medical School. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. What will a prominent stem cell scientist bring to Harvard Medical School? Well, there's no punchline after that question. The medical school is starting 2017 with a new dean, George Daly, who is, in fact, a prominent stem cell researcher and longtime Harvard faculty member. And George Daly joins us now to talk about his plans for the medical school. Dr. Daly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
Well, congratulations. I want to start off with...
Well, thank you. It's really been a whirlwind week. We've had a great kickoff, and I'm really, really excited to launch into this new role.
If you could name two main goals for Harvard Medical School, what would they be?
Wow, I wish I had just two. But, you know, top of the list is to build upon our research excellence, to increase our influence. You know, we have some of the world's greatest scientific thinkers, and you know, it's our responsibility to act and really advance human knowledge. And second is to leverage the remarkable clinical community that we have to increase the delivery of effective and compassionate care, not just to our local community, but increasingly to patients all across the world. I mean, Harvard Medical School, we're really full of doctors for the globe.
Hmm. Yeah, describe that a little bit. How do you see the medical school in sort of the world of global medicine?
Well, you know, I think it's incredibly exciting to imagine, you know, the potential impact of Harvard Medical School. I mean, in the aggregate, we are arguably the world's most dynamic and influential biomedical community. We have an enormous presence locally, but through our efforts in global medicine, we are really, you know, taking the world's most advanced and compassionate care all across the globe, you know, whether it's in Haiti, in Eastern Europe, Middle East, Africa. You know, everyone is well aware of Paul Farmer, Partners in Health, and just the remarkable impact that he's had.
Right.
But as I've become dean, I've realized that we have communities at all of our major medical centers, physicians and dedicated nurses and staff who themselves fly all over the world to provide really world-class health care. And it's one wonderful way that Harvard Medical School is impacting patients everywhere.
Will you continue your research in your stem cell lab while you are dean of the medical school?
I think it's going to be challenging, but I am going to try. You know, I am first and foremost a physician scientist, and when the president and provost of Harvard asked me to take on the position, I said, yes, I am excited to lead Harvard Medical School, but I want to continue my role as a scientist. I think it helps me be relevant and also to understand the challenges of many of my faculty. Mm. I'm going to downsize my lab considerably. I have tremendous colleagues. My very, very close colleague, Len Zahn, someone I've worked with for years, didn't want to give up those scientific challenges. And, you know, I'm going to do it as long as I've got the right kind of help from my colleagues.
I understand you'd like the medical and business schools at Harvard to work more closely together. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's very accurate. I'm going to start by trying to preserve adequate time to spend with my wife, who happens to be a professor at Harvard Business School. But also, you know, we are, at the Harvard Medical School, part of this biomedical ecosystem. I think arguably Boston and Eastern Massachusetts has this remarkable conglomerate of scientists, biotech companies, pharma companies, and the tremendous business and entrepreneurial interests that Harvard Business School represents. So I'm part of what's called Life Lab, which is a new sort of incubator laboratory that is set up at Harvard Business School. We have new companies being incubated in that space, and I'm part of the advisory committee there. That's just the beginning. I see the ability for Harvard to translate its fabulous science into new technologies, new treatments for patients, and ultimately new companies as an engine not only to improve human health, but to build on the economy of Eastern Massachusetts and keep us really the global leaders in that.
Mm. Now there are some obvious questions about that, and I know that you've also been quoted as saying that you hope that Harvard Medical School will partner with our brethren in pharma, I believe is what you said, and that made some people uncomfortable. You know, what about potential conflicts there, and how do you guard against that to make sure that the patient and the science are really at the forefront and not profits? What do you say to folks about that?
Yeah, Harvard Medical School has always been at the forefront of defining ethical norms and high standards to prevent these kinds of problematic conflicts of interest. Now, I'm not so naive as to not realize that when we've got thousands and thousands of engagements, there are potential problems. But we keep a very, very tight view of this. We have very strong reporting requirements and transparency. And I think it's really on us to be able to maintain relevance and enhance translation while managing these conflicts of interest.
Raising money, though, is going to be an issue, probably a part of your new job. But Harvard Medical School, I'm told, has had annual deficits of between $31 and $45 million for three consecutive years. What do you think, as dean, you're going to do to try to change that?
Bill, there's no doubt that we're just one of many medical institutions that are facing serious financial challenges. This is something that is a problem across the country. You know, we're in a time of great uncertainty around federal funding. We are seeing challenges to our major medical centers as reimbursements dwindle and regulations increase. So it is one of my main goals is to provide for fiscal stability. That comes with a number of administrative efforts. It comes with a major effort around raising new resources, both through grants, foundations, and a large emphasis on fundraising. We are very fortunate. Harvard has a global brand. Many, many visionary philanthropists wish to invest in us and in, human health via their investments in Harvard Medical School. I mean, what better community to invest in given the talent and reach of our faculty?
Mm. Is that your biggest challenge ahead as dean, do you think?
Put everything in a long list. I've got a huge list of challenges, whether they be cultural, educational, clinical. But in fact, as I've really gotten to know this place over the last few months, I realized that those challenges pale in comparison to the amazing opportunities. Mm-hmm. And this place has extraordinary resources, intellectual and personal, and I'm really feeling the tremendous optimism of our faculty, our students, our staff, and my goal is to bring that all together so that we can be even more impactful and influential in the future.
Mm. But with the deficits that we just mentioned and then increased collaboration with business, do you think you have to take increased steps then to even prevent what might be only a perception of a conflict of interest? You talked about taking steps to make sure there were no conflicts and to increase transparency. You're going to have to be more aware of that, do you think?
Well, it's something that I've lived in my own career. I mean, I've had, almost four decades at Harvard as a student, as a clinician trainee, and then as a faculty member. And during that time, I've also interacted very, very considerably with our biotechnology community, both as a consultant, advisor, and as an entrepreneur starting companies. I have had to submit to the most rigorous reporting requirements for both the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and Harvard Medical School, and it feels like it's worked. And I think our faculty assume that that's part of our responsibility, and as dean, I'll keep a very, very close watch on that. But we have to be comfortable managing those conflicts in order to be able to have the impact that I think is really our core mission.
I have two questions left in our last 2 minutes here, so I'm just going to try to get both of them in. There's a new curriculum for Harvard Medical School students. Can you explain to me the overarching theme of that new curriculum?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the other great and exciting opportunities as dean. I mean, how do we inspire students and prepare them for lifelong learning when the sheer volume of information that they need to be a physician or a scientist is staggering? So we have flipped the classroom. We now have a very student-intensive strategy where they do all of their preparation up front, and then they come into the classroom not to be lectured at, but to actively engage in problem solving, group-based, so they have to learn how to work in teams and collaborate. And it really turns around the kind of educational expectations. I think that's really exciting. It's been very, very inspiring for the students. On the clinical side, we're getting them into the hospitals earlier. They're eager to see patients. They get inspired by patient care. And then in the third and fourth years of medical school, which were traditionally just hospital-based, we bring them back to the classroom, and we work at the interface of science and medicine. So what we think that's going to do is train a new generation of more scientifically founded and mechanistically founded physicians. I think that's going to be very exciting.
And how will you measure your success?
Well, the traditional measures, we have measures that include standardized testing, but I think when we look 10, 15 years down the road and we see our trainees as the leaders of our not just our local but national and international medical centers, it'll be pretty clear that this has been a success.
All right. Dr. George Daly, stem cell researcher and the new dean of Harvard Medical School, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for your interest.
Well, that's it for today and for this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.